Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin, it's how we get there.
Because I don't want to go backwards. I want to keep going forward. Together, that's exactly where we're going to go. God bless.
I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
This is Rewind, Wisconsin Eye's look at this week in the Capitol. First, the sights and sounds. Wisconsin Eye was there when LaTonya Johnson talked about some caseworkers in Milwaukee County, 1,600. And we have some, we have Gwen Moore, very inflammatory statement at the Democratic State Convention. Andre Jock says, you know, we qualify for food stamps in my family. Well, it's so good, let's go right to Wisai was there.
For example, in Milwaukee, because Milwaukee is extremely large, those caseworkers have on average 1,600 clients per caseworkers. 1,600.
On my legislative salary, we're blessed that my wife is able to stay home. I just found out last night through the Access program that DHS believes I qualify for $70 to $90 a month in food share. I don't need food share, just as I didn't need it in college. I was fine with ramen and Captain Crunch, too.
Here's one of the differences with a fully insured plan versus a self-insured plan, is if we get contracts that say that they're going to reduce costs by $40 million, you take it to the bank.
Yes.
Whereas with self-insurance, they're all estimates.
The risk.
The best message came from Brown County, and it was, Republicans go to hell. And maybe we can get a conversation going with them. We need to tell our people.
I've been to and through a plethora of meetings in the last 4 years. And the same thing's going on in the neighborhoods. Ain't nothing changing.
You can talk about specific Milwaukee issues, but we can only deal with statewide issues. We are a state legislature. We're not the city council.
When legislation comes up on Milwaukee, don't you vote on it?
We cannot pass legislation specifically for Milwaukee.
I didn't ask you that.
We pass statewide legislation.
If a geology student says, I'm sorry, but the Earth is only 6,000 years old, rejecting science that says that the Earth is considerably older than that, is it not okay for a professor to tell that student that they're wrong when the student is saying that based on religious beliefs that the Earth is only as old as, you know, 6,000 years old in the Bible and that sort of thing? Can a professor tell a student in that case, no, you're wrong?
So, but this bill stays out of the question. I mean, out of the classroom. Yes, the Earth is 6,000 years old. That's a fact. But we can discuss that outside of these.
You said outside, that it is a fact. You do believe
yes.
It's a fact.
No,
but
I do.
Okay.
But we stay out of the classroom in this bill.
JR, this was the week that we thought we'd have progress on K-12, the corrections budget, and some other important issues. They didn't even meet. What happened?
Essentially, we hit the roadblock we always hit in joint finance. So I've covered this committee for a long time, as you have. There's always a moment in the committee's deliberations when things get difficult because they do low-hanging fruit like the Supreme Court, like, you know, these smaller items that aren't big-ticket areas. But then when it gets to K-12, transportation, corrections, like the big ones, they need a pause for some reason trying to figure things out. And Brace right now in the middle of the pause. The pause, though, is deeper than what I've seen in a while because it's not just like one issue. It's not just governor versus lawmakers, it's lawmakers versus lawmakers and the governor's over here. So right. We're kind of in this break, and I'm not sure when that break is going to end just yet.
Okay, let's talk about one of those issues. Let's talk about, first of all, they're in the unique position that you and I haven't often seen of being able to throw a lot more money at K-12.
Mm-hmm.
So the governor in February says, let's throw $649 million more, and the more is important. Let's deliver it with $200 more per pupil year one, 204 year two.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Assembly Republicans coming at it, and they seem to be pretty unified, a different way. They want to go 150 year one, and is it 200 year two?
Yes.
Yeah. But they want to dial back Walker 649 to 580. my close here?
Yes, they want to do that. They want to do a little bit more money in the general school aids formula. But the biggest thing that's a difference, the biggest sticking point, is they want to allow for an increase in property taxes, especially for low-spending school districts.
92.2. So
these are ones that we locked into revenue caps 2 decades ago. And these were districts that, in the words of some Republicans, were frugal back then, 20-some years ago. And because of the cap, which basically says you can spend this much per kid between property taxes and state dollars, well, when you locked in 20 years ago, you're getting the same increase as somebody locked in up here. So they've had a smaller
yes.
pot of money.
Yes.
These guys are saying that's not fair anymore. We need to do something to help them out. How do we do this? They want to do it by relaxing the cap for them, for those low-spending districts, for property taxes. That is a major no-no with Governor Walker because he wants a property tax bill in 2018 that's lower than 2014, and you can't get there with that.
Yeah, and that prompted Senator Fitzgerald to issue this release. Speaking of the Assembly Republican proposal, a proposal that raises property taxes, and this is key, picks winners and losers within our school districts, is a move away from the position of both the governor and Senate Republican caucus. This picks winners and losers refers to the 208 districts that would be able to levy the additional 92.2, and if my math is right, the 236 that wouldn't be able to. Now let's listen to Speaker Voss's response when he was asked about Senate Majority Leader Fitzgerald's statement. It's very short.
From my understanding of talking to the Fiscal Bureau, since we've had this Joint Finance Committee, we've never had individual budgets when one party controls everything. So there is absolutely no reason to make threats. I'm not going to make threats.
JR, before we talk about the property tax fight, which I want to get to next. It appears to me that there's some other nuances of the Assembly GOP plan. First of all, the governor recommended an $87 million upper in the school levy credit. Assembly Republicans want to shave that by 35, and they want to fold in their package on when school districts could pass referendums. Mm-hmm. Do you think those stick in some eventual compromise?
There could be some compromise. The big thing, though, that this is the sticking point. The Assembly Republicans want to dial back the per-pupil categorical aid increase. Now, this treats everybody the same. No matter property wealthy, property poor, you get yep. the same boost per kid. And what I've heard from Senate Republicans is these districts, when they saw Governor Walker's proposal, locked that money in. And their minds are like, we're getting that cash. So to them, dialing it back is not fair right now. So that's a major sticking point that I don't think the Senate is prepared to come off of. And Governor Walker really wants that money in the K-12. And to be honest, that's part of what he did it was because it shores up this vulnerability he's had for a couple of years about K-12 funding. He now is a guy who wants to put this, as he talks about, a record amount of money in the K-12. Well, it's a different approach from the Senate Republicans. So we'll see how that plays out, but that's a major sticking point. That plus the property taxes, the two big things you got to watch with that.
Thanks.
Fight.
Now we got to let's get into the property taxes because this mythical median valued home. Mm-hmm. When I looked up from the Fiscal Bureau information paper, the net property tax on this mythical home was $2,831 in December of 14, which you pay in mm-hmm. either then or you pay the next
yep.
year. So the fight is over. What it's going to be in December 2017 and December 2018. Mm-hmm. And Nygren told me yesterday, okay, the governor's plan is at $2,832. We're at $2,842. Here's what drives me crazy. It's a $10 difference. Mm-hmm. Why is it so symbolic? Why is it hanging them up?
Because Governor Walker is obsessed with the property tax bill. He has made this a major component of his first reelection bid, what we expect will be his second reelection bid, not counting the other election for the recall, but he is run on property taxes. And he has said over and over again, your property tax bill in 2018 will be lower, and he keeps talking about now. The number was lower then has been kind of a little bit in dispute.
Yeah.
We were thinking it was maybe 2010, you know, when he first took office. But no, he is now pointing to a speech I guess he gave the realtors in 2014 or something like that, saying it'll be lower again in 2018 than it was in 14. So to hit that number, you have to do some things that he wants to do. The Assembly GOP, with how they're doing their education package, they're talking about more money in the classroom.
Yes.
So when you're talking about dialing back that lottery school levy credit, that's about taking money that would go just toward lowering property taxes mm-hmm. toward putting it into the classroom, school mm-hmm. expenses. Mm-hmm. That's why you see this difference of $10. Now, the hitch is, they're chasing a number, essentially. we both know that my property tax bill has changed over the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. But I live in Madison. Madison has passed referendums.
So did my school district, Monona Grove.
So when you are doing what Governor Walker is doing, you're trying to chase a number to lower property taxes by buying them down with state aid. That becomes a difficult situation when someday, because we're buying lots of stuff, the forestry tax,
yep.
It's a major portion of, you know, getting rid of, like, lowering property tax bills. Tech colleges, was that 4 years ago now? We bought them down by $400-some million. You keep buying them down means you're using state money instead of property tax money. At some point, the GPR train runs dry, and we hit a recession, and all of a sudden these bills come due. What's your choice? Cutting a lot of these things. So Governor Walker's idea is he wants to find a way to take all these things off the property tax roll, pay for state money.
Here's what drives me crazy about this mythical median-valued home. It doesn't take into effect. Your district passed a referendum. My district passed a referendum. We've had some economic recovery. Your home on the east side of Madison hopefully is worth more than it was. And that is also, I hope, same thing is true for mine. So you have, is it fair to go to chase this average median valued home when the difference is $10? I'm sorry, that's the last time I'll refer to it.
But for Governor Walker, it's part of kind of his pledge to voters. It's about property tax, keep them lower. He's been talking about tax relief. He talks about on Twitter all the time about lowering how many billion dollars in total tax relief, you know, since he took over.
Five.
You know, property taxes are a big component. This is for him a key pledge and a key argument for his reelection bid, which all assume is going to come in 2018. So to make his number, he has to have this happen. Now, here's the thing. If you pass Governor Walker's budget as he proposed it to the legislature back in February, it would not meet his pledge right now because of property tax. We have a property tax credit for the school from
the lottery.
Lottery, thank you. And we had to reestimate some costs with
school choice
program. That has taken his budget and made it move it just out of whack with his own pledge. So he needs lawmakers just to do his budget as passed, tweak that, hit this number. They're not getting along so well right now. So this domino is the most important one of this entire discussion, what's left. If they can agree to what number to use, it tells you how much GPR is left for everything else. That clears the way for deals on taxes, for deals on K-12, and maybe even bleeds into the transportation discussion they still have to have.
Yeah, so now let's turn the page and go to some of these tax discussions. The governor on February 8th recommended $203 million in income tax cuts. But you and I are picking up increasing vibes that they're going after the $261 million elimination of the personal property tax.
Or at least a phase-in, but yes.
Oh, well, they'd like to get there. Representative Dale Coinga on Joint Finance, a CPA, he tweets, "Locked myself in the office this evening to develop a plan to eliminate the state's personal property tax." John Nygren, when he stopped in the press room this week, said, "Yeah, we kind of agree that that's a good long-term goal, but Nygren's quote, income tax cuts go to everybody." So, but I'm hearing, are we in agreement that there's momentum growing to eliminate the personal property tax?
So the personal property tax is a property tax that is on businesses for basically what they have inside the building, right?
Yes.
Various equipment. It is a complex tax to figure out because you have to take things like depreciation. From what I've been told, you have to fill out all these forms, your tax guy, send it over here. It's a very complicated, burdensome process, according to those who don't like it. So they want to do away with it. Now, just like we talked about buying down tech colleges and the forestry tax, to get rid of the personal property tax, you have to buy it down with state dollars. Otherwise, you and I pick up that bill because that $261 million would go on the property tax rolls for us to backfill the value in our homes.
Right.
To avoid that, you need GPR. Where do you find the GPR? The Walker income tax package is, like you said, about the same ballpark.
203 to 261.
So one of the questions I've heard this week is that smaller bump, you know, or cut for people worth more than this for businesses to what the backers say free them up for to invest more in their companies, create more jobs, et cetera. The flip side is you set up an argument of you went for businesses versus middle income voters.
Right. Especially when you have the backdrop of the manufacturers and ag credit, which is costing, I think, more than $200 million. And it was passed to help manufacturers and ag. And the new figures out this week, last year, 2016, we lost 3,800 manufacturing jobs. And we're, I think, number two in the nation for manufacturing jobs. So what you're saying is if you give business an additional break by eliminating the personal property tax, you potentially give Democrats an issue saying you helped them with the personal property tax repeal or phase out, and you passed the ag credit. At the manufacturing and ag credit, and by the way, we lost 3,800 manufacturing jobs.
And you also have some Republicans who are a little bit uneasy about that contrast. So we'll see how that plays out. But I do get the impression they're moving towards some kind of action on the personal property tax in this biennium.
Definitely.
Do they kill it all in this one? I don't know. As we both know, they like to phase things in, which basically means you get to celebrate it now and pay for it later.
Right. And just a P.S., I ran into Senator Howard Markline, also a member of the CPA caucus, and we were walking. He let me walk with him a little bit, and I said, Senator, from a public policy decision, what's best, the governor's income tax cut or personal property tax repeal? He said, personal property tax repeal. So there is growing momentum on that. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, new subject. You and I both spent part of last Friday and Saturday at the Democratic State Convention. Let's open with Tammy Baldwin and the reelected party chairman, Martha Lanning, and the vice chair, David Bowen, and a snippet of my interview with Senator Kathleen Vinehout because she won the straw poll that we'll be discussing later. Let's listen to these voices from the Democratic State Convention.
There are already two multimillionaires planning to run against me in next year's election, and a third guy already has his own super PAC from out of state.
I think a lot of people talk to both of us about a two-year term not being enough to really turn things around when we have been losing races for as long as we have, and they're seeing real change happening, and we're working with the grassroots up.
And the changes that we are implementing in the party, now that they will be more rooted into the next election, we are very confident that we are going to be able to compete a lot more than we were before.
So the way I think of it is not the traditional way of, you know, strongly liberal to strongly conservative or strongly Democrat to strongly Republican, where you're fighting over the 2, 3, or 4% of independents
in the middle.
I think of it as very engaged to I don't give a damn.
JR, I want to talk about your straw poll. Mm-hmm. You had, I think, 446 respondents. They got more than 1,300 delegates and alternates. So
I think we're closer to 500, but yeah. So we usually get, that's a pretty decent turnout for us, you know, for a straw poll, get people to stop by and vote. But yeah, about around 500 votes.
Vinehout won it, followed by Representative Dana Walks, followed by Mike McCabe, who I'll be interviewing here separately in a few minutes, and then Erpen Bach, Andy Gronick, Malin Mitchell, the firefighters president, who was the recall candidate for lieutenant governor who lost that.
We were told by the party was not going to run, which is why I got to speak at convention, but he said, well, I wasn't really speaking, I was just introducing somebody, and by the way, it's too early to say anything about 2018, but that's besides the point.
That's beside the point. General impressions on your straw poll, any surprising results?
Kathleen Vinehout, she's always at these things. She shows up at conventions. She does like small county party events. She's created a currency with people show up at these conventions. These are, I talked to the Republican convention, Leah Vukmir winning, you know, last month.
Yep.
It's the base of the base of the base. And they like people that they can talk to and touch, and they know that they're real on their issues. So she's done a good job of that. That's part of the reason why she run.
Does winning the straw poll give her new momentum as she continues to go around the state speaking to the Barron, Price, Taylor County Democrats?
It doesn't hurt, but when I've talked to operatives, they're like, well, look at how much money she's got in the bank. She had less than $5,000 in campaign account on December 31st of 2016. That is not a launching pad for statewide campaign. Now, I understand there are people who don't like money in politics and think it should be about more than that. But the reality is Governor Walker is going to raise $30 million, $35 million, $40 million, who knows what he's going to raise. You can't compete with that kind of money unless you are going to try at least to be an active fundraiser, and we haven't seen that from her so far.
When I interviewed her, I asked her about, she got 4% of the vote in the primary for the recall election, the Democratic primary. Do you consider that an aberration and she can broaden her appeal?
Well, I'm sure she can broaden her appeal. It's been some years since then. But and she did also, by the way, go out on the campaign trail in 13, was laying the foundation for a bid for governor then, but then got a car accident, broke her arm, decided not going to run. So she's had an opportunity to broaden the appeal. If you go back and look, she didn't do that great in her Senate seat in 2014 or in 20, 2010. So she hasn't got a great track record as a campaigner when it comes time to rack up votes.
Okay, the other part of this was the re-election of Martha Lanning. I'm told that it had been since 1997 that a sitting Democratic Party chairman had an active, viable challenge. Mm-hmm. So that's a long time. But she got 722 votes, Brian Kennedy 569, Eric Finch 50, Joe Donovan 48. You surprised at the gap? Even if Finch and Donovan weren't there, she still would have won.
Yes. What was interesting, talking to people about this, they told me that she basically made a successful argument that she had enough time to build the infrastructure, that essentially 2016 wasn't entirely on her.
Okay.
Lots of people in the Democratic Party are unhappy about how things turned out last year. They lost the presidential race in Wisconsin the first time since 1984, lost a Senate race in a presidential year for the first time since 1980. They are the smallest minority in the assembly since the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So people are angry, but where do you channel that anger? Brian Kennedy, from what people tell me, didn't do a good enough job of being the person to funnel that through to make a credible argument of why he should replace Martha Lanning. She made the argument of, give me more time. 2 years wasn't enough, actually 17 months from the day I was elected until the election. Give me more time. She's talking about turning on the off year. She's talking about the five regional offices they've opened, the statewide director of those overseeing those regional offices, that they are building infrastructure that will work. Looking forward, the key for Lanning is going to be not just this infrastructure she's building, but can she persuade outside groups, national Democratic groups, to invest in Wisconsin, make that turn operation work? Are they going to be on the ball when it comes to the coordinated campaign? Democrats, like, they call it the coordinated campaign. So Tammy Baldwin, the party, legislative candidates, they all kind of work together in this coordinated campaign. Will that be on the ball this time around? I am pretty sure, talking to people, that Tammy Baldwin will not allow that ball to be dropped. She's going to be much more in tune with that stuff.
She has to be,
but
given Johnson's reelection. Go ahead.
Yes, but Martha Lanning has now got the opportunity to prove her vision works.
Okay.
So now it's time to show us.
Okay, now let's go to a 72-year-old guy who sat in the back on Friday night, and Madison Mayor Paul Soglin then told people, you know, I'm thinking about it, after a few months earlier telling the State Journal he wasn't interested.
I had talked to some people going to convention and heard that he was at least giving it some thought. So we included him in a straw poll, and then I saw him on Friday evening, talked to him. He said, yeah, and his explanation was that he thought for a long time, in his words, that a Madison liberal, especially as far left as I am, he said, can't win statewide. But after seeing how Bernie Sanders did, he thought, well, maybe. And then he says he goes out at least once a month, I think, with his wife and some friends to supper clubs outside of Dane County. And he'd go out to these supper clubs, and they'd say, you should run. And he's like, wait a second, I'm hearing the same thing here that I am back home in Madison, so maybe I should give this a look, you know, and kick the tires. It goes to the why not me theory of the Democratic field for governor right now. They're seeing President Trump struggle, Washington, D.C., and going, okay, normally in an off year, the party in power in the White House is punished at the polls. Donald Trump is at Bill Clinton numbers from 1983, which, by the way, 94 is not a good year for Democrats. So maybe that's going to foreshadow what's going to happen in 2018. So why not me?
He also told you he's younger than Bernie.
Now I'm younger than Bernie.
How's that for a campaign? A bumper sticker, younger than Bernie.
But he's part of this why not me. So you're going to see a lot of people kick the tires in this thing between now and next spring. I do anticipate that after June 30th, we'll start seeing some people announce, because we have a fundraising period in Wisconsin of January 1 to June 30th.
Yeah.
And if you're a Democrat,
that's a reporting cycle.
If you're a Democrat, do you want to go out there and announce June 1st, have 1 month to fundraise, and then have your number come out versus Scott Walker's, who turned on the jets, you know, earlier this year and said, okay, I'm going to send a message, this first report, what I'm going to do? Doesn't make any sense. So July 1, after that day hits, somebody's going to start announcing it.
Okay, so at an appearance on Madison's West Side, Verona Road, the governor was there saying, pass my transportation budget, which they're no closer to passing another huge impasse, but we're trying to do a show without saying the two words transportation funding. But the governor was asked about, if Mayor Soglin was a Democratic nominee against you, let's listen to what Governor Walker said.
It'd make for a lively race. I mean, he's an unabashed throwback to the 1960s radical liberal out there, and you know, the idea that he thinks that Bernie Sanders is a good model for him, I think makes for a great contrast. It probably does him well in Madison, I doubt it does well across the rest of the state. I'd love to have that battle, the distinction. I don't think most people in the state believe that Madison is the way they want to be. I think they want their each individual communities to improve the way they see fit there, and that'd be a great contrast, though.
Governor Walker would love to run against, and you and I would love to cover that, wouldn't we?
It'd be a contrast.
It would be. Let's walk down history lane a bit. 5 years and 4 days ago, Governor Walker became the first governor in American history to survive a recall. He looked it up. He got 53.1% of the vote. He got more votes in that recall than he did when he was elected the first time in 2010. Milwaukee Mayor Barrett got 46.3%, 1.16 million votes. He also got more votes than he did in the 2010 election. 5 years later, assess that victory for Governor Walker.
Oh, Democrats.
Surviving the recall.
Democrats will tell you that they helped create the Walker machine by trying to recall him because he became a national figure and created a national fundraising list, which became the launching pad for him to run for president.
Yep.
Because he had a narrative to talk about taking on the public employee unions in a blue state like Wisconsin, which, you know, we should be considered more bluer than we are now. A blue state like Wisconsin, if I can do this here, I can do it anywhere, we can do it anywhere. And just the fundraising operation they created because you could tap these small dollar donors. And what happens is it's expensive to reach out to people via email, letters, and cultivate a list. But once you have that list cultivated, you can hit them up for 10, 20, 30 bucks at a time, and what happens, it adds up. So yeah, the 10,000 donors get a lot of attention, but these small dollar ones, when we're talking thousands and thousands of them, they add up over time, and that's one of the results is they create the Walker machine by trying to take them out.
Okay, just a PS on this subject. When he won the recall, the governor got 53.1%. Mm-hmm. When he won in 2010, he got 52.6%. When he won in 2014, he got 52.2%. Here's what strikes me. Governor Walker wins. When he wins statewide, he gets 52.1 to a high of 53.1. That is 0.9 percentage point. So there's no 54, 56, 57 wins, percentage no. wins for Governor Walker.
And I don't know if anybody left in Wisconsin could win like Tommy Thompson used to do, like Herb Cole used to do.
Right.
I don't know if those people exist anymore, because one of the other results of that recall is that we so divided the state. We already were divided before in some ways. I mean, lots of people. Like, the country has been for a long time. But we divided it that much more in Wisconsin because of the recall. And there are still hardened lines. Now, what's interesting is for Governor Walker, his numbers were so solid after the recall election of like where his approval was and disapproval. We saw the first crack in that armor when he ran for president.
Yes.
And now I've seen Marquette poll in a little while. He's improved, but at one point to get back into positive territory. He hasn't been there a long, long time. And the theory was before that, you know, yes, people hated Scott Walker so much they'd walk through fire to vote against him. The people loved him would walk across broken glass to vote for him. So was there still that much passion for him
right.
in 2018, especially in a bad environment for Republicans, if that's going to happen with next year.
Let's say one more subject quickly before we get to the stock picks. With all that's happening in Washington, the President Trump's scheduled to come here for a Walker fundraiser next Tuesday. Do you think the odds might be 50-50 given all the distractions in Washington? Do you still think it's going to happen?
As far as I know, I mean, it's going to be a big ticket fundraiser for him. So it's going to bring in some decent cash, I would assume.
Okay. It'd be the first time the president came since April 18th when he went to Snap-on Tools.
Mike Pence will be here on Saturday.
That's right. There's some talk, the governor said, that the president could have another public function. Have you heard any update on that?
Not yet.
Okay. All right. Let's go to your stock. Go ahead.
So Kathleen Vinehout, so we already talked a little bit about, you know, her in the straw poll. It was only a third, roughly, a little more than a third of the universe of voters. She also won our straw poll in 2015. Now, in 2016, the party blocked us from doing a straw poll. But this kind of backs up that whole, like, literally that connection with the base of the base with the party. Mm-hmm. The question for her becomes, how will she do statewide? Can she raise the money, build the infrastructure, be a credible candidate? But even though she did well in the straw poll, the news out of convention on the governor's race was Paul Soglin. Really kind of interesting for a guy who's in his 70s, who hasn't really thought of this candidate before. The big question for him, though, is, you look at the map and like where Democratic votes come from in Wisconsin, a primary. I can give you the first two counties. Can you name the third? Milwaukee and Dane. What's the third county for the most number of Democratic votes in a primary?
Waukesha.
Boom. So you think Dane County, that's Paul Soglin's base. He should have like a leg up these other guys because he's got Dane County, his backyard. But Dane County politics are a blood sport, hand-to-hand combat.
Yes.
So in some ways, Soglin doesn't really have what you'd expect because he's, and maybe he's endeared himself to, he's enraged over a 50-year career. And there are people who go, well, wait a second, do we want to have somebody who's been in politics for 50 years right. as the image of somebody to... But anyway, really interesting news coming out of the convention about Paul Soglin about running for governor.
And just to PS on Paul Soglin, Wisconsin I has invited Paul Soglin to come in for a 15-minute candidate interview. It may happen next week. Okay.
So next. Rebecca Dallet. So she announced she's going to run for Supreme Court.
She's the Milwaukee she's County Circuit Court judge.
Also a former prosecutor. Trying to kind of put herself in the middle of Michael Gabelin, who hasn't announced he's going to run for election yet, but we think he's going to. And then attorney Jim Burns, and she's going to try and run up the middle. We saw that play in 2016. And what happened for Joe Donald? He got 12.2% of the vote. In a nonpartisan primary, with you have a clear conservative, a clear liberal, and some in the middle, it's tough to run. There's a different dynamic this time, though. Tim Burns is not a judge. Rebecca Dallet is. So back in 2016, you had two judges. Kloppenberg was an appeals court judge. Donald was a Milwaukee County judge. Is it a different dynamic having a judge versus an attorney? And oh, by the way, the attorney who is running as an unabashed progressive, like no holds barred, flat out, I'm the progressive candidate, where Dallet's trying to say I'm kind of left to center, like her speech at the convention. She said one of the greatest days of her as a judge was when the Supreme Court struck down bans on gay marriage. She grabbed her robes, got back into town, and ran down to marry people. So she's appealing to that base in some way, but also saying I'm still in the middle. How do you pull that off in an election? Looking ahead, all that matters for the next 6 months are fundraising and endorsements.
Right.
So this is kind of like just the primer for this race, but watch how much money they raise, watch how many endorsements they rack up. That's the test for now going 6 months.
It's a February primary, April 18 election. Mm-hmm. Okay, falling.
So the Joint Finance Committee, I asked Bob Lang this week. That committee is 106 years old.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time the committee did not pass a budget? And he said no. I think there's still a good chance they're going to pass a budget.
I think there is.
I think I've covered, I don't know how many budgets, how many finance there's almost always a roadblock, a speed bump in the finance process where we get a break. Now, 2 years ago, the break was almost 5 weeks. It took a long time to figure it out. 4 years ago is K-12 funding. A couple of Senate Republicans wanted more money in K-12. They took a break for a few days. Is this break a week? Is it 2 weeks? Is it till October when Robin Voss gets married? We don't know. But I've never seen, nor are people I've talked to have seen, a week in finance where they cancel two hearings, and in that week, one leader of one house proposes a whole new K-12 funding package. The other house says, not only is that package not going to go, not working with us, but we may do our own budget. This is kind of a little bit of a threat to the finance process in some ways, but the bigger picture is this is an indictment of the Republican ability to govern right now in Wisconsin. They have controlled everything for 6 years. They've got both houses of the legislature, they've got the governor's office, and they're right now not getting along. I've been asking why. There are a couple things to this. One, a governor walked out the theory that we have big majorities, and this happens, we have big majorities. You know, people pick things to fight about.
You get a little too healthy.
Two, you have veteran members of the Finance Committee. These are not newbies on this committee anymore. They've been around for a long time. This is one of the only times we've seen two chairs go three terms in a row together on a budget. They know their stuff. They're not afraid to change Walker's budget and express some authority on what's going on. Also, Governor Walker left 2 years ago, dropped his budget, said, okay, guys, get this done quickly. I'm going to go look at running for president. And what happened was, not only these guys kind of feel their oats about we can do this.
They grew.
But they also
in this budget drafting role
grew some tension with Walker about, well, you were gone. We're fighting about this stuff. What right. the heck is going on?
Okay.
So this is kind of what's going on. They're going to get there eventually, maybe, but this is not a good week for finance, what's going on.
Okay, let's end this way. You asked me which county produces the third highest amount of Democratic votes. The answer is Waukesha. The quote of the week, JR, he's just new to this.
Paul Ryan about Donald Trump.
Okay, you win. I'm Steve Walders.
And I'm JR Ross.
That's a rewind for June 9.
Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. Sharing one goal, enhancing the quality of life in Wisconsin through the development and maintenance of a strong transportation network. The Transportation Development Association of Wisconsin. It's how we get there.